I would like to propose to you Vox's decision box, and Ed is going to help us here with the way in which we might walk through a decision. Your part of this might be tonight to think of some problem, some case that we could test as we run something through from A to B. This is the way Vox's box looks. In the first place, there is this, which is the decision point. And Vox says that obviously out here somewhere you have one of our favorite words in English, namely problem. Seems like everything in life turns out to be a problem. And that's an overworked word, perhaps. Maybe we should think of some other. Mystery is a good one, especially for a retreat center like this, but a problem or a crisis that calls for a decision. And Vox says there are several dimensions to this as you begin to consider this and run it in that direction. One of them is past. One dimension is past. One dimension is present. And one dimension is future. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but decisions may have a past and a present and a future. For instance, what would you put into past considerations of the problem or the crisis you're talking about? Here you might have your religious formation. The person who is raised in a strict religious background simply can't avoid that baggage when this problem comes up. It's a piece. Custom. The things that have usually been done. There are people in Iowa that I used to live among who never wanted to do anything except what had been done before. Whenever you came up to a question, the group might be evenly divided between people who didn't want to do anything and people who wanted to do only what they had done before. Experience. This is another one. Experience tells us that in Indiana, excuse my Midwestern jokes, but I'm sort of a Midwesterner. In Indiana, the way you get something through a church meeting is to make an elegant presentation with a four-color brochure about a proposal that you want to have voted. And you've got time on the agenda and it gets full discussion and somebody in the background will say, it won't work, and they'll vote it down. The next year you go to the same convention and you have a very modest mimeographed piece that raises the same proposition. And you get this before the group, and someone in the back will stand up and say, look, we've talked about this and decided before, so we shouldn't do it. They vote it down a second time. The third time you go in with a half a piece of paper, make the proposal in one of the odd moments of the convention, someone will stand up and say, look, we've been talking about this all this time, now let's get busy and do it. And so it's voted through. That's a way of illustrating experience and decision making. Now in the present, the factors might be necessity. That is a crisis. Your illustration the day before yesterday was the dam is broken and you've got to do something about it. You don't have time to ponder this alone. There is an urgent necessity in the present that demands a decision. There are certain options in the present. You hear that from Washington all the time, people keeping their options open. That is to say, there are some choices, possibilities, and constraints. Some things are open, some things are closed. And your discussion in the present will tell you something about that. This morning, you mentioned understanding the problem is terribly important. In other words, you better know all you can know about these things, because the more complete the understanding, the less likely you are to have your decision go askew somewhere. Then there are peer groups. In the illustration that you cited from George Farrell today, the man is in the boat at night, drifting toward a waterfall, and must decide, is he going to row like mad? Is he going to try to steer the boat? Is he going to let it drift, hoping that something will catch him? In any case, his decision may be wrong. He may go over the falls anyway, but he's got to decide something. And you complicate that a little bit if there are a whole bunch of people on the bank hollering advice to him, conflicting advice. You see that often, and you could label that the influence of peer group, all the expectations that people put on you, or maybe even just your self-expectation. Out in here, the future dimension, the consequences. That's a question. You know very well there will be some consequences like success, possibly, if you spell it rightly, or guilt, or sorrow, or as in the Old Testament, the visitation of the sins of the fathers unto the third and fourth generation of their children. And it is in this complex that Vox says, you pour your problem. The case of Catherine Quinlan, that famous one about pulling the plug, comes to mind. Family was a very religious family. There was a priest on hand. Nobody knew for sure what the consequences might be, and Catherine is still alive, I'm told. Now that's one, you could run a problem through this. Just curious to know, first of all, let's ask the specialist in the ethical decision making here what he thinks about the big D as we move this way and put these things in and come out on this end. Maybe we should just open up to the comments and refresh our minds.
This is very interesting. It just occurs to me as we're finishing this sort of process here, that perhaps another ingredient in this future call is some kind of vision of how we think things ought to be, or might be, or could be. And that's a different kind of ought, perhaps, from the kind of ought that is incorporated often into our norms or our standards. Something ought to be done this way. But rather, something ought to be this way because it's the function of a utopia, in a sense, a utopian vision, or in more religious terms, the function of the kingdom of God, what we understand the kingdom to be. Because how we decide to act in the present will oftentimes, I think, be affected very much by what we expect will happen in the future. So that's just one of these.
That's one of those comments that comes from the management people. I think it's Peter Drucker or somebody of that ilk who says that there is no such thing as long-range planning. It's the decisions that you make now that affect whatever that future is going to be. A strong possibility that doing A right now is going to set up a situation where B, C, or X may not happen simply because you foreclose in present decision what that will be. And therefore, long-range decisions are the decisions you make now in some ways.
And the other side of that then is how do you avoid paralysis? If your decisions in the future can lead to A, B, or X, as you say, and you're not sure what the outcome is going to be, how do you avoid paralysis?
Well, who would propose a kind of problem or case study that we can grind into the box? Does that intrigue anybody in thinking about this? Don't any of you have decisions to make besides say, well, this is a terrible place to ask it, I guess. Our constraints are all gone. The most critical questions are, how soon can I get to the ice cream line, maybe? Or will I go to a forum and prolong the celebration for another until 10 o'clock?
Well, that wasn't a problem. All we had to do was to get you to delay the opening of this meeting.
And it was a very easy.
So we set the problem aside, you see, and then resolved.
And I think
that was the thing I was telling you before. If you can keep the, if you have enough time to keep the discussion going so that you can reach out and pick up all the experience and knowledge you can surround the problem, then you can come to a better chance of getting a decision that is reasonably accurate.
All right. Now, it seems to me that you've just said something about another possibility here. If the present allows time, you can go back and do more with that kind of business.
So how do you establish the parameter of time and also have some knowledge of how close you are to the waterfall? In other words, how much time do you have? And then how do you use that effectively?
I think that particular analogy helps us most when we approach the question of making decisions at all. Isn't that right? That's the classic illustration of the proposition that not to decide is also to decide. That's not the typical kind of problem that those of us face. It has a past and a present and a future. I mean, that in that sense, true.
This morning, or yesterday morning, you mentioned the fact that a lot of our young people who have been born in the last 20 years, since the time of Japan and the bomb, have been more and more looking toward a future which has no future. And so the problem is, we don't know what the time is, but we know the consequences. And so, mostly through fear, we, young and old, are striking out, trying to freeze the bomb or do something. And I have the feeling that we're not addressing the problem as much as we're trying to stop it, and we have a gut feeling that we can't. So we're looking for a solution that lets us sort of divert the boat into the rocks before we get to waterfalls.
Okay. We want to foreclose certain consequences.
That's right. By diverting. The decision must be to not solve the problem, because we don't seem to be able to stop progress, as it were. So we must do something.
No, you can't stop momentum. It's not necessarily progress.
Well, progress toward
that's right.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
So the only thing I could try to get smart enough to find a good set aside tactic. And
that's a good example. Also,
develop a plan.
That's a good example of a problem where none of your past experience helps you very much. We've got hundreds of years of experience dealing with diplomacy in various ways and dealing with warfare in various ways, and yet a lot of that body of experience just doesn't help you at all when you face atomic warfare. And so
that's right.
This whole past thing just sort of drops away.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that we're sort of duty-bound by the past within governments, within religion, within whatever, that we keep saying, we can't do it. And yet, to me, if you look at the present and the future, what the problem is and what the consequences could be, it's, you know, 10 bright people from various countries could come up with a solution that if we could, you know, if we could some way consent to follow that, we'd have no problem. But we've kind of got the constraints of all of the past, I guess, the bureaucracies, the, you know, all of these kinds of things. So I think that we're probably talking about a total new way of decision making rather than something that's into the system.
What would you say about that? Totally new way of decision making. Was there anything in that comprehensive view that you gave us today that suggests that there are alternatives that haven't been discovered or tested or treated? Is there such a thing as you're proposing, a new way of making decisions?
Well, I don't suppose there's ever anything totally new, but I've raised in my mind some of the same kinds of questions about in this particular area now, when you talk about, for example, the diplomatic efforts at negotiation. Does the momentum of the protocols that are followed, sort of the custom, the bureaucratic procedure that is established, make it, I'll say, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to really have substantial breakthroughs in terms of new ways of understanding the adversary? Because we get so locked into a certain mode of trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not sure that we're in that case talking about a different method of decision making necessarily. You know, our processes are still working the same, but we're somehow tied to a bureaucracy or something over here, a diplomatic process, which is not necessarily the same, I think, as the decision process. Deciding what we ought to do is,
you know, in a sense of like the times 2,000 years ago, and yet Christ is, you know, coming through and cutting through the political, the system, which is probably as, you know, evil, corrupt, and whatever else that we're, you know, experiencing today in terms of the problems that they have, making decision on land, making decision on distribution of wealth, making decisions on peace and, you know, welfare and taxes, and the same kind of thing, except they don't have the money, they don't have the tremendous you know, problems with the media and stuff that they have. But to me, it decision making probably isn't totally new, but I think that the kind of courage and the kind of willingness to try something new, and I think of you know, some of the newer management type of things that get away from the bureaucracy, the books that have been written on that.
See, I think this is goes back to another question that was raised this morning in terms of leadership, and which comes again to something of this vision that I was talking about for the future. If on the basis of what we think life is about, we can somehow catch a vision, a future vision, that will affect the way we do things, the way we make decisions. And I think that somehow that has to break open the procedures that we've used in diplomacy and all of the other.
Okay.
And if there isn't that vision, then, you know, you're back in the scriptural observation that without a vision, the people perish. I mean, that's pretty effectively what's going to happen.
Before we get to your comment, I'd like to tail in something, put it on the board, because it seems to me that when you say problem, crisis, we also ought to put question up here. Suzanne Langer has said that every question has within it only certain answers. And the thing you need to do when you get to an impasse of this kind is to reframe the question in terms that you've been discussing now. The question is it a military thing that we're after, or is it a diplomatic thing that we're after that best satisfies the vision that we want? Now that might be one way of talking. You see, you simply shift the framework by asking the question in a different way, by posing your problem in a different way. And that's very, very important, friends, when you get to an impasse. Throw all that stuff out and try to reframe your question in a different fashion, at a different level, with some other factors involved. Because there are only certain answers implicit in a question.
Clear example of that in this whole area, I think, is an understanding of security, for instance. Do we understand security now in military terms, or do we have a wider notion of what global security is about. That would be a reframing.
That would be a reframing of the question. And in that case, what you're saying is the interests of all of humanity are involved, not just the interests of the parties that seem to be mostly antagonistic. The Patagonians and the Eskimos and the Hottentots and all sorts of people have a vested interest in what we do about atomic warfare. But we have to look around a little bit and frame the question more broadly in terms of human interest and in terms of patriotic interest. Now that's reframing the question. Now, you had a question across the way and I cut you off.
Well, just the whole issue of reframing the question or looking at the background, I mean, that's always essential because the only way you're going to get away from your ties is to look at them and realize that they're there. I don't think you can deal with decision making in terms of only the present and the future, because then by trying to avoid the past, you are ignoring it. And if you ignore it, you're going to get stuck in the same traps. You've got to look at and see where we got caught up before. Now, the only way you're going to do something new is to change what you've done in the past. And you can't do that unless you realize what you've done.
Okay, let's go here. You haven't had a chance to speak yet. I will take these two.
If we both agree that nuclear war cannot be a just war, is it ethical to have this enormous amount of missiles and prepare for this? Is the pure possession of missiles ethical?
He's asking a question. He's looking at me, but I'm not going to answer it. He's asking about the morality, I guess,
right,
the ethical correctness of the possession of weapons as so lethal they can wipe out the earth. Mm-hmm. And if you have them, there's a temptation to use them, but if you're never going to use them, why have them? What do you say about the ethics of possession of nuclear weapons? Catholic bishops have spoken on this one.
Well, I have a feeling about nuclear weapons. I think it's wrong to have them. I think it's wrong to make them. I think it's wrong to use them. And totally incorrect. And yet they're here. And they do exist. And they are owned by people over whom we have no control. I have no control. You have no control.
None of us
and
have.
And so there's an indeterminate future. And so that is the problem. Not what we think about the problem, but that does exist. That is a fact of life.
Okay.
And so this, we must deal with it. That is the raft that's in the middle of the river flowing toward the waterfall. Now, we do not know whether they will be used, and whether we will be wiped out or not. That's an unknown. The other part of the problem, as I see it, is that, well, in fact, there are two problems. There's a kind of a problem that has some background. There's some knowledge that surfaced at some time before and been answered and solved in some manner or other, whether it's a personal or a public or a private problem. There are other problems that are newly created and have no background. The nuclear problem is one. We've never had this problem before. We have no experience in handling it or solving it. And so what we must add to our future is creativity. We have to create a new concept of how to handle a new problem that has no background to it.
Does analogy work? Is there anything? Is there anything in our experience that is analogous to the problem we have with nuclear warfare, such as, say, poison gas?
Yes. In fact, I have almost a personal experience with poison gas. My brother was in chemical warfare during World War II. World War I was the initiation of poison gas. And there were many, let's say, tragic benefits to the people who first used it in Germany, and also consequences, because they found that the wind shifted. But they were prepared for that. Anyway, poison gas was introduced, but it didn't solve the war. Tanks won the war. But then in World War II, every side was prepared for poison gas. And they had lots of it. Both teams did. And so my brother was on the American team, and they produced a lot of it, along with a lot of gas masks. And so when they went into, the first time that the problem surfaced was when they went into North Africa. And so when they landed in Tunis or Tripoli or someplace, the first landing, the first thing they took ashore was poison gas. They took it ashore in carboys labeled chlorine or whatever it was, and they stored it in open fields on the outskirts of town with barbed wire and guns and guards around it, but you could see it. And they did this so that the other side could see that we had more poison gas than we knew that they had. So it was never used. It was a no-win situation.
It's a deterrent.
It was a deterrent. And so we have a somewhat similar situation, which we all think is wrong, and that is we're in an arms race. And somebody seems to think that having more of it than the other guy does is going to be deterrent. We're not sure if that's going to happen. So that may not work at the time. That would be an experience of a weapon.
It is some other information, some data. You wanted to get into this.
Yeah, I think that we should probably remind ourselves that this the arms race discussion is a case example to help us discuss decision making rather than the main topic, right? But it brings up some hard problems, namely the difference between individual decision making and group decision making. The idea of taking a problem and rotating it so it becomes a new problem you can solve very neatly in a totally new way is an idea that works extremely well in individual decision making. But in the case of arms race concerns, you've got a group decision process, and the group is basically 3 billion people. And it was more difficult in that case for one person to say, I've got this neat way of thinking about the problem that solves all the issues. We just have to get all of the constituted authorities to step aside for a little while we figure this thing out, okay? Very, very hard. And so a lot of what makes the arms race concerns so difficult is that in very large scale group this decision making, a lot of these neat things don't work as well.
Okay, I'm glad that you said that, because I don't think that we can go very far with the problem of that scope in trying to analyze this. We probably can't do very much more with the creative idea you offered the first day on limits. The ethical question that faces us is, should we do all that we can do because we can do it? That raises the question of limits. Limits on all sorts of things, not just arms, exploitation of the earth, and all sorts of questions there. But once again, when we talk in terms of public policy, we're talking about group decision making, and that's not very easy. Does anybody know of an example where an individual, seeing one of these imponderables, has made a decision that's made a difference? Yes.
Now each individual make a decision that it is wrong, then that can lead to group decision quite fast. And especially Christians say, if we have lots of Christians in the United States. And so if an individual decide that it's wrong, we can voice our decision. And as a church, we can also
it's hard to answer the question, but you see, in a free society where not everybody is guilty but all are responsible, we probably have some necessity for picking up what we ourselves can do. And I think that's where in terms of that arms race, the nuclear business, the Catholic bishop leadership statement makes a fantastic amount of difference to Lutherans and Presbyterians and all sorts of religious people. Methodists have made a strong statement this summer also.
or in the Middle Ages, which is the most recent history I know anything about, given the periods of warfare and all that, what a group of monks did was to establish religious holidays. You see, you could only fight in those days in the summertime. And so that's why you find all the saints' days and feast days, because if you spaced them out right, there wouldn't be enough season for people to get together. That was either the peace of God or the truce of God. I think that was probably the truce of God. And the peace of God, another thing that they did, you see, was to say, it's okay if you guys want to fight, but we're going to excommunicate you if you fight on cultivated land where crops are growing, because people need that food to eat. So you can go ahead and fight any place you want to, but not on tilled fields. Well, the peace of God and the truce of God virtually controlled that primitive kind of warfare. Now that's just a nice creative solution. They were using the tool they had. Excommunication, which is a terrible threat in those days, of course, but they could enforce that. And the historians will tell you that because of the peace of God and truce of God and the effect that had on reduction of violence and productivity and so on, the Dark Ages began to flower as the Middle Ages. There's a comment back here.
I like to say too that an individual can make a difference. I thought that Christ called me in the two times I was involved in Target Theater. It was last year and a couple of years before that. We had a whole week set up with many speakers of different backgrounds, from the military, from the science, from the humanities, and it was very informative. What it was mostly to me was getting together with others who had the same feelings about it, who were very concerned, and I think by coming together and getting it out in the open, I think it gives you much more strength and confidence and hope. And I would hate to believe that we don't make a difference. I think that it's so unchristian not to feel there is hope. I mean, we are based, our life is based on that.
Now, what was the way you did it was to take some problem like the arms race or something like that, and on the basis of some religious background or some common interest that derived from that, you put together the experience of a variety of people against that sort of necessity to talk about options, possibilities, constraints, in the hope that something would come out the other end. That
all the letters, the written petitions, the one up, and Bishop Heinhausen talked to us several times.
Yeah.
We had the filmmaker, Kramer, who made the first movie on this, what was it called, On the Beach, I believe.
Which
was really a pioneer film in this field. And I couldn't possibly go to all of the discussions. I mean, we had the two. But we had group sessions, and I felt I had very mixed up feelings, and I, up to about 4 or 5 years ago, I really did not quite take a stand. And to me, for example, I thought it was time for me to take a stand. And I know where I was coming from. I went to the Second World War. And I always hear from my friends, you cannot be without the pen. And the argument always came up, you know, these are deterrents. But I think every individual has to face this issue really, and ultimately it's up to the individual to really take a stand. That's what it meant to me.
It seems to me that one way to look at what you're saying is that you are changing the constraints piece of it down here, because you are affecting the political climate within which the politicians have to make some of the decisions, and they are bound by the constraints of the political climate, and you're setting about to alter that piece of it, making it more possible for them to decide closer to the way in which you'd like the decision to come.
By changing the constraints, you're doing something about the question as it comes to some other people. Then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, of course, I think this is the right approach, and the point is
each one of us has a say in an organization. And we live in an era of organizations now. And one of the strong organizations in this country happens to be our church. We may not be the strongest, but we have a say. We have a word to say, and people will listen. Some people, at least. The other way we have, through our church, and the church should not be involved in state, I understand. But we do have a vote. And if we could as a group or as a nation of concerned people, elect people who we knew would have a deep concern towards solving these problems, rather than staying in one little corner of the country and taking care of their interests as prevented them by certain interest groups. In other words, if we could put on a political pressure as well as a group pressure, then at the same time develop within the leadership of the group an in-depth study experience pattern, which would allow provide more experience to apply to the problem, whichever part of it is unsolved. I'm sure that this is a modern example of what you asked for, an example that you think of, and it occurred to me that we recently had one of those, and that was Nasser, Israel, Carter, three men who got together, and they were in the process of going at the root cause of the Middle East problem, which is the grab for land and water between two groups, the Arabs and the Israelis. And that is primarily a struggle for survival between two groups, and they see it, each in their own part. And the only way that problem can be solved, obviously, is to settle, or arbitrate, or settle the issue on a fair basis to all the people involved in that, regardless of what their religious background is. And Nasser had taken the great initial step of going and making friends with the other side, and he was in the process of trying to get them to cool off the West Bank settlement and go back, you see. And whether he was being successful, I don't know. Until finally somebody got to him, and they foreclosed that option, and that sort of went back to more fighting, more killing. But I think that's a good example of what one person with political pressure can do. And I think if all we have to do is develop the leadership to take this thing into some form of action, whatever the problem is, it doesn't have to be nuclear problem, it can be a lot of other international problems. I think that's the one kind of approximate, maybe one mundane problem, but since we have an expert from Minneapolis here, what kinds of decision-making process goes on in the church council, in the American Lutheran Church, for instance, when it comes to maybe Bishop Price's efforts in Moscow and that whole religious peace movement, or just where we stand in the formation of the Lutheran Church and all those kinds of things. Those are decisions that are being made by people, and that leadership is a little more approximate, a little more handleable for us. Maybe you respond to that after a bit.
One construct to think that came out of the totality ever was also that we made connection with our sister city and church camp in Russia. The high school groups went over there. We collected petitions, making up in Russian as well as in English, and collected all those, and they were personally brought over to church camp. And the slides were shown afterwards, and people did get a feeling. We built a bridge. Mm-hmm. And I think I felt it had to start someday. It might be very minor, and it might not bring a big political thing. But one of the things in the sessions I went to was interesting to me. We had to write down how we felt about Russia, what we knew about Russia. And it is absolutely mind-boggling what comes out of these sessions. If we consider Russia our big enemy, and I guess that's what we think nowadays, don't we?
in the arms race. I mean, I'll be talking about Russia and the United States mainly, and find out people know very little about Russia. And most of it is all very negative. And then evaluating to where that comes from. Why are we feeling that way? That's interesting.
And the churches are taking initiative. You know, the there was a big team of 200 and some people this summer who went from American churches to Russia. Invasion of Peace, Bruce Rigdon from McCormick Seminary led it. I haven't heard the reports, but they came back last month and there was a good news conference in New York. Bishop Christ has been to Moscow two times, I think, hasn't he? And I'm going to say something about that next week in some prepared remarks, but that's one of the solutions that was proposed as early as 1950-something or other by Arnold Toynbee, that religious leaders find a way to say some things about the old, primitive, bad religion, which is on their side of the Iron Curtain communism, Toynbee says, and on our side, something else, that civil religion would work. And it is up to the church to begin, up to religious people. Now, he didn't say church, it includes church, religious people, Buddhists and a lot of other folks who've been at those meetings, to say something about that kind of religion, which is a worship of mankind itself in its own power.
I didn't quite get the thrust of what you're saying. Were you talking about the religious group in Russia as related to...
The religious group in Russia has invited religious people to get together, and they've been there two times to talk about this whole business.
To whom did they talk?
They talked to each other.
I mean, the religious group. Okay. And what was the concurrence? What did they agree on?
I think they agreed that there ought to be some voice raised against this threat to humanity.
Well, aside from that, what did they find within each other's religion that they could agree on? Not about the problem.
I don't think that was what they got together for. Well, I think they got together as persons whose commitment to mankind for religious reasons raised concern about this problem. That's what they were doing.
In other words, but they did agree that they wanted to solve the problem of peace for mankind or whatever it was.
You perhaps are closer to this because of the president's office.
I don't know the specifics either, but part of the clue or key maybe is in the title. It was something about a conference of those concerned about the sacred gift of life. And I think it ties in again with the notion of what human life is about. If life is understood as a sacred gift, mm-hmm. That would indicate that there is a creator who stands above human life. And I think that ties in with something that I thought of a minute ago, if I can put it together now. Peter Berger, you know, talks about religion as serving two different functions, one negative and one positive. That is, it can alienate people, in his terminology, making it seem as though things as they are the way they must be, and you must conform. Or it can de-alienate or relativize the things that are on the basis of a view of what is transcendent, on the basis of a view of that which is ultimate, that which is God, mm-hmm. which frees me to do something different. And that, I think, is again part of the function of leadership, to carry on that vision that things can be different.
I think in talking with anyone on the other team, on the other side, we have to come to the understanding that we all are God's people. They and us. Not their religion and our religion, for their government and our government, but as human beings on this earth, we are all God's people. You start from that discipline, and we know that, we can agree on that. Then we can start to come together on some other common ground. If you find any common grounds at all, we can start to work from that out to the problem.
Yeah, I think that these Moscow discussions have been framing the question in a wider frame than just, say, American Christians, Russian Christians. It's been opening it to a broader religious concern. It's one way of reframing a question, mm-hmm. letting somebody else in the discussion, and concern for life, you see, is at least the framework of the doctrines of mankind these religions have, something can be affirmed. I don't think they got together to talk about their differences religiously. I think they got together just to talk about that problem and make a voice about it. Excuse me again.
I think it's really interesting that our discussion this evening has come to this, to settle so much on this war and peace. But I don't want to steal all my own thunder, but it seems to me that if one of the significant problems that we confront is nationalism, the idolatries of nationalism, then we can again reach into the past, in a certain sense, reach into our own tradition, which talks about a confession of the Catholic Church of which we are a part, that is the universal church, the Catholicity of the church, the nation transcending character of the body of Christ, is one of the ways in which our faith serves to de-alienate or relativize the whole issue in a way which makes it possible for us to begin to understand people across ideological and national boundaries, because I can recognize also that the body of Christ is present in Russia, as in the U.S., as in other places.
I think one of the real hopes that I see is that all of a sudden we've gotten to the point where we're thinking global, but, you know, I don't think that's true. I think we used to say, I'm a Lutheran because I want to learn to live in peace and harmony as a Lutheran. And the Catholics thought we were saying the same thing. And it wasn't that we had any, you know, meeting the minds. And I think maybe even nationalism of countries. But maybe with the tremendous thing we're seeing with the media and the satellite telecommunication, all this, we're about at the break point. And I think rather than pessimism, we need to have the optimism to proceed ahead with a tremendous amount of hope. And I see like the Pope and the efforts of the Lutheran Church and various, you know, you mentioned the bishops. And to me, it's kind of an exciting time that maybe we each have a chance to be a catalyst to say, we as a people on this planet need to have one religion in a sense of that global thing, of how do we as a people, and for the first time say we as a people, every, you know, 3 billion or how many ever on the planet coming together. So to me, it's probably the biggest amount of hope, and that's why I kind of say maybe we can cut the crap of the past off a bit and look at something we've never had a chance to look at before in its entirety as a one world view. And it is really exciting, but of course, you know, pretty altruistic thinking too.
I just wanted to throw an idea. I don't know if I can get it across very nicely. I listened to a lecture by Walter Brueggemann in Seattle. I don't know if you know him.
He talked about
history making. And he pointed out that most likely in his view it would be the marginal people, he said, that would be making the history. We should be looking at the sort of underground sort of movement. I don't know if I come across right. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was just fascinating to me. And I really feel so inadequate to bring this across. It was one of my really highlights of the evening. It was last year I listened to him at university. I do think we are in a really peculiar time in history. And I know it's very, very important to really confront these issues, every individual. And I think it's already better to talk about it and maybe take this and maybe do the wrong thing than not doing anything, I think. At least I feel very strong about that.
Brueggemann would have said that God has chosen the weak and the powerless. It's kind of the kingdom of God principle, the last shall be first.
Mm-hmm. Well, he gave us the hope. I think he got across to me that we do make a difference. And I felt that very strongly. And I believe in that. I mean, there's no other way.
Biblical faith would say something like that, I think. Yeah, there's a comment over here.
And
then we have to...
A few minutes ago, you asked for some examples of one person coming up with a new idea that helped things on the map scale. And Martin Luther King did that in injecting into the late 1950s in the American South the idea of nonviolent resistance to segregation. And that was a good example of a tactic that probably surprised his friends and foes both enormously. Mm-hmm. And sort of made everybody go, well, we never thought of that before, okay. And confused both sides very much, and it worked very well, at least for a few years. And you don't hear very much of it anymore. But while he was alive and during a period of 10 years, that created insight and made quite a difference, because it put the impact of
Okay.
I guess what I'm hearing from you is very much of how I'm feeling too. I feel that the churches though, or maybe it's the pastors or it's the churches, that are not giving the support to those of us who are trying to take risks. And that's a concern of mine. I've seen that in our district that there's a lot of people out there taking risks, but they are not getting the support from the church. And maybe you can comment as far as, you know, what's coming from the national office in the ALC. You know, I don't feel like the support is coming from there either. And how much longer can, you know, I mean, we're in an ideal situation here at Holden Village where we are around a lot of stimulating people and supportive people. But again, you know, going home to where we are not in that environment, and how to deal with that.
I quite don't understand, you say, us who are taking risks. I think we all take a risk just by being here, you know, but mm-hmm. Are you referring to something specific?
I guess of what you were, you know, commenting on, if we see an injustice taking place and working for justice,
I agree with what you're saying. I come from a Lutheran church in Seattle, and when we joined, we came up from North Southern California 15 years ago, and I remember there were a lot of no-nos in those forums, and we have come to grips with some of the issues we can talk about, but I still think we have not easy ground of bringing these issues up, and I feel the same way. I feel very frustrated. There are many people who still believe in the separation sort of that was always told of church and state, and politics doesn't belong there. And these are life and death matters, and I know it is very hard, and I wonder if any of you would share this and have the same difficulties in your churches to bring these issues up.
Well, I think we have to be respectful of the time. Compliment is about to start in a couple minutes. I think we have to say a couple things about this risk-taking business. Archbishop Hunthausen, and you talked about the trouble with the Vatican, he's taking risks and he is going to get wrapped. And Martin Luther King and that whole crowd took all sorts of risks. But there's a difference, and I think that's a very important issue. Maybe we ought to talk about risk-taking as a separate topic. I was kind of hoping that at the beginning we might take some medical problem that would give us a little bit something that happens in our family with aging parents or dying people or something like that would give us a chance to think about decision making in a closer personal way. You chose to talk about something else in a broad sense, and that's perfectly okay. The time is yours. But I think it would be important to say that when we talk the way we have been talking, there's a difference between decision making and strategy. We've been talking strategy a lot of the time, and there is a decision that's made to conclude a certain kind of strategy. That's a little different thing. I just want to thank you all for coming, bearing in mind. I'm sorry I wasn't watching the balcony, and if somebody up there was raising his hand and wanting to lob in a comment. I missed it. I'm sorry about that. But I appreciate the time and the effort you've all given in going this far. Obviously, these forums are open-ended kinds of things. And some of you would like to say what we ought to do on Thursday night if we gather again on risk-taking or something. I'd be glad for the suggestion.
Thank you very much for coming and helping us tonight.